Hello, everybody. Welcome to this edition of the Tech Doctor Podcast. I'm so glad you joined us. And today I'm absolutely thrilled to have a woman that I caught up with at the NFB convention. Her name is Deborah Kendrick. Deborah, welcome. Tell us a bit about yourself, if you will.
Well, thank you so much, Robert. I am thrilled to be here and to be invited. You're asking for trouble when you ask me to tell you about myself because I don't quite know where to begin, but I'll begin at the very present moment. I live in Cincinnati, Ohio. I have three children, two of whom are launched and very delightful, productive adults.
Excellent.
And the third one is still living at home, still in the launching process, so it's just she and I these days. I have made a career of being a freelance writer and editor for the last 30 years.
Well, take us back about 30 years, and I'm really curious to learn a little bit about how you got started as a freelance writer and editor, and especially, I don't know how many people who are blind were writing and editing for a living back then, but how did you get that started?
Well, first of all, I knew that I wanted to be a writer by about the age of 8, and that's what I told everyone when I was growing up. I got a lot of encouragement from teachers in high school and professors in college for my talent, but if they had career counselors or anything of that nature in those days, I certainly didn't have one. My degrees are in English literature, and I taught some, as you know, many of us do while I was in graduate school. I was a teaching assistant, so I taught classes in freshman composition and so forth. And I took a little time off in between, actually, and taught blind children, even though I wasn't certified to do that. Those were the days when you could do things without all the necessary paperwork. But I knew what I wanted to do was write, but I didn't know how to go about it for a career. So my first experience with discrimination as a blind person had to do with applying for a writing job. I wrote these impassioned, I was only 20 when I graduated from college, so you know I didn't know much. I wrote these impassioned letters to three television stations and thinking that I could write commercials. And one of them, believe it or not, offered me a job on the phone. We had a phone interview, and he was dazzled by my writing, by my recommendation letters, by my transcripts that I had submitted, and said they had a news, an entry-level job in news operations. I was ecstatic. So I went in for the interview that was to be just a formalization of things. And you might say I could hear the guy's jaw drop when I walked in the door with my guide dog. Instead of an interview, I had a barrage of insulting questions. Who wrote your letter? Who typed your letter? When I said, I did, he said, you couldn't possibly have done that. How could you set the margins? How would you know where the keys were? How did you get here? Etc. And the job was gone. So fast forward a few years. I applied to graduate schools, and I got my teaching assistantship, and I did that, and did some other things that were pretty interesting. I wound up doing some very unusual teaching that involved blind kids and blind adults. But eventually, I spun back around to what I really wanted to do was write. And I started publishing poetry. I did very well, really, for a novice poet. You know, poetry is really hard to sell. But I won some contests. My poetry was selected for some anthologies and some chapbooks. I was kind of on the circuit, you know. I was doing poetry readings around Ohio. I was received an Ohio Arts Council grant. But, you know, you can't make a living doing that stuff. So I started submitting articles to magazines through the mail. Now, I'm thinking back to that horrible experience at Channel 24 where I was diminished because of my blindness. So the last thing I was going to do was write about blindness or tell anyone that I was submitting articles to that I was blind. And fortunately for me, a lot of freelance writers have the tales of the 100 rejection letters that they've saved in a folder to remind themselves. If that had happened to me, I'd be doing something else today because I don't take rejection very well. But very fortunately, my first article sold and my second article sold, and I was on a roll. I've always been involved with social justice kinds of issues, so I wrote about anything that wasn't disability. I wrote about children who were abandoned or neglected. I wrote about shelters for women and women who were victims of domestic violence. I love to this day doing profiles of people where I sit down and interview someone and write about that person.
What was that very first magazine article that you sold? What magazine and what was it about?
Well, now the very first did have to do with blindness. The very, very, very first was an article that I submitted to Dialogue Magazine. And interestingly, it was called How Do You Eat This Stuff? And it was a funny article about the complications of eating and etiquette as a blind person. You know, and I don't even remember it very well, but I told funny stories in it, like, you know, eating a salad once with some kind of posh people and sticking my fork in what I thought was a circle of cucumber and it turned out to be a circle of lemon, and knowing not what else to do, I swallowed it.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
You know, things like that.
I've had those experiences where I ate a whole pat of butter like that before.
Oh, yeah. But the funny thing was, I didn't hear from them right away, and because it got lost, they were in transition from one editor to another. And when Louise Kimbrough came on the job and found it, she wrote to me and she published it right away, and she sent me a check for $25, and I wish I had framed it. I thought about it, because I didn't know if I'd ever publish anything else. And then I sent her one more piece that was about, I was very domestic in those days. You know, I was growing all my own vegetables and making all my own bread and had started having children and was making the baby clothes. And, you know, I was all into that stuff. And so I wrote an article about making Christmas ornaments from bread dough. And they published that. And shortly after that, she looked me up. I was at a Ski for Light event, my very first, and she came there to find stories. And she found me, and she launched me in a way, because she said, "You are such a fabulous writer, and I'm sure that you probably largely publish in the slick magazines." That's what they called them in those days, you know, the print magazines with slick pages, you know.
Yeah, sure, of course.
Harper's and Glamour, and mm-hmm. And that's what she thought of me. And she said, "But any time that you ever have for us, I will appreciate it so much." Well, I was pretty full of myself, so I went home and I sent an article to the magazine of the local paper. In those days, a lot of newspapers had Sunday magazines, and we had a very nice one in the Cincinnati Enquirer. And I think the first article that I sent them was about people who had experienced near-death experiences. I rounded up some people who had had those kinds of experiences and wrote an article about it, and it sold. And so then for maybe a couple years, I was kind of in the closet. I was afraid to meet any editors. I talked to them on the phone, and I sold things through the mail. And then there was an occasion where I was doing some writing for the Catholic newspaper, a lot, and a friend of mine asked me to write about this day they used to set aside called Access Sunday. You know, bring a crypt to church day.
Uh-huh.
And she wanted me to write about it. And I said, no, I can't do that. I don't write about disability. And she begged and she begged. And, well, you know, they tell you in school, write what you know. And even though by this point I'd published pretty many things, I agreed to do this for her, and I ran around and I interviewed a bunch of people with all kinds of disabilities, and I mixed in my own feelings in it. And basically everybody said the same thing. You know, we don't want a special day. We just want a place at the table. And it was so, it was just so liberating. And the piece got so much attention. And some of the attention was negative. You know, there were some people in my neighborhood who were in this prayer group with this guy who was brain injured who had said to me, "I love my prayer group, but I want them to stop praying over me. I don't need to be fixed." And so these people, you know, they were really mad. And that's fun for a writer, you know. It's fun to have people kind of irritated with you. So that was kind of the beginning of coming out. I then began meeting editors, but there was still a period where I would say, don't ask me to write about disability. But a point came where I really liked doing that. You know, in any job, networking is important, and using opportune moments when they occur is important. And so in 1986, I was doing lots and lots of volunteer work in my kids' school, in my church, at our radio reading services, Girl Scouts. I was named an Enquirer Women of the Year. The paper here names 10 women every year, and they do a big posh gala do thing. And by that point, I'd sold several pieces to the Enquirer newspaper and magazine. But at that event, what I was more excited about was that I shook hands with the publisher. He knew my name and he knew my face. And I went home and I thought, I've had this idea rolling around in my head for a year or two to do a newspaper column on disability. If I'm ever going to pitch it, now's the time. So I did. And I wrote him a letter and sent samples. This was 1986. People were not writing in mainstream newspapers about disability.
No, they weren't. They really weren't. And I'm struck by the fact it sounds like by that point you had really made a 180 turn from that very first very discouraging television writer interview.
I had.
And that's kind of a remarkable thing to think about. You had really come full circle back to where you started, but it sounds like in some ways with some true confidence, some true belief in yourself this time.
I had, because a lot of other things were happening along the way, part of which was my introduction to technology, and we'll get to that in a minute. But also, I was married for 22 years, and my then husband, he used to say, "You were born needing a cause, and before you realized that your true cause was disability, you know, it was, I was involved in civil rights and war protests and women's liberation and migrant workers protests." And I guess he was right. That's part of who I am, a very strong sense of social justice. And once I stumbled into disability stuff, I was hooked. And so, yeah, I did a complete 180. But I didn't want to write a help the handicap column. And I didn't want to write a how do you get your handicap parking sticker column.
Right.
I wanted to write about civil rights.
I rather rudely interrupted you because I was so struck by that 180, but close the loop. What happened when you submitted the stuff to the publisher?
Oh, it was so cool. It was really one of the finest moments of my 30 years. I wrote him this letter, sent some samples, and wrote apparently a pretty convincing letter of why the time was right for a daily newspaper to launch a column on disability issues. And 4 days later, so basically by return mail, because this is all snail mail in 1986, I got a handwritten note from him saying, "This is a wonderful idea, and there's no one better to write it than you. Our managing editor will be calling."
That's fabulous.
Yeah. And so for 18 years, from 1986 to 2004, every Sunday, I had a column in the Cincinnati Enquirer. Over the years, there were times when it was syndicated in a fair number of papers, but I picked up the Columbus Dispatch in 1993, and that today is the only paper that the column is in, and it's every other week. And every few months, I say, I can't do this anymore. I don't want to do this anymore. And then I get a few letters from people telling me how important my column this week was, and I think, well, maybe I got to do it a little bit longer. So that's where that is.
So essentially, it's changed some, but you're still doing that column.
Absolutely, yes.
Wow, yeah. Since 1986.
Yeah. Today was column day. I wrote my column this morning. I was in real nostalgia loop this morning because the Americans with Disabilities Act 22nd birthday is July 26th, so that was what I wrote about. And I began it with the memory of that, too, was another milestone for me because I was invited to that signing ceremony twice. I was on an advocate list and I was on a journalist list. And that.
Did both of you go?
Both of me went.
Okay.
And by now the publisher of the Enquirer had moved on. My greatest fan had moved on, and I was stuck with an editor who didn't like me or what I had to say. So when I asked him if they would send me to Washington, first he said no, but someone above him said yes. He actually said to me, and there's a real technology story there too, but he actually said to me, well, there's no way you can write a story and send it, so you just call me and tell me about it and I'll write it. And I thought, not as long as I'm alive will you be writing my page one story.
Exactly.
So, but it was cool because, you know, disability journalism, we didn't have that term yet. There wasn't, you know, now we talk about that. But in the press section, there were other people who had disabilities who were writers, but I was the only one writing for a mainstream publication. It was a thrill, and I didn't take it lightly. I knew that I was really fortunate to be doing what I was doing.
And at the risk of sort of jumping around a bit, in terms of talking about technology, how did technology help you get that story back to your newspaper? Or how did you manage that?
Well, I'm thinking, let's back up. I told you before we came on the podcast that I'm an accidental techie.
Okay, I'll go for that.
So let me tell you how I accidentally became a techie.
Great.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to this. This sounds good.
My world was writing, and that was all I wanted to do. And what I learned in those first few years was, you know, when I was in college and graduate school, I thought that the only way you could be a writer was to be a novelist or a poet. But I began to realize, as I began making my living writing, words are everywhere, and it doesn't matter which words you write if you write them well. And I realized I could write about anything.
Well, I'm really realizing that as you talk about it. My gosh, you covered all kinds of topics in your early days.
Yeah.
And it seemed like the pattern, though, was that you wrote about things that you felt passionate about.
I did. But sometimes, you know, I had gigs sometimes writing for really funky little publications that I would, you know, they'd send me out on bizarre things, you know, write about the husband and wife who have set up business as a dentist and massage therapist in one office.
Uh-huh. So,
okay.
So you do that then because it's your job, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
Or once I had to write about an April Fool's Day parade.
So you started out as a writer, not necessarily at all focusing on technology. How did you write, Deborah? I mean, did you record interviews and transcribe them into Braille, or did you use a typewriter? How did you physically do it back in those days?
With a slate and stylus. I wrote grade 3 Braille. When I was in high school, because I was in public high school and didn't want to attract attention to myself, I began writing all my notes in spiral notebooks, so thin paper.
Mm-hmm. So they wouldn't make too much noise if they were really
right.
Thin.
And so you can punch really, really fast.
Uh-huh.
I could take basically verbatim notes. This one story that I did on abused and abandoned children, I went to this facility to interview this woman, and I showed up. We had talked on the phone. She saw me, and I knew she didn't expect me to be blind, and I knew there was a panic, like, oh, my God, how am I going to get her up the stairs or whatever? So I followed her up to her office, and we sat down, and she told me later when I knew her in another context, she said, you know, when you started punching those dots, she said, I was so fascinated by what you were doing that I would have given you any company secret you asked for. And I think that was often true, you know, because I early on seemed to get people to talk to me very easily and spill their stories. So I took notes with the Slate and Stylus. I wrote first draft to this day. First draft is usually the only draft. So I wrote the story on a Perkins Braille writer. I read it into a tape recorder, and I used a dictation pedal to start and stop the tape and typed from my own dictation. Then I had to have someone proofread it, and there was one person that I trusted to do that. So she would come over, she would proofread, and inevitably, you know, there'd be a mistake on a page or two. There'd be a page or two that had to be retyped. So it took a while. Yeah. So in 1984, three things happened almost miraculously simultaneously that led to technology. The first one was I was at a cocktail reception kind of thing for a nonprofit that I helped fundraise for, and the director of our state voc rehab was there, and I knew him pretty well by then because of serving on committees with him and so forth. And he said, tell me, because by now my stuff is all over town in print, you know, everybody knows that Deborah's a writer. I can actually introduce myself at parties as a writer and not feel like I'm faking it. So he says, pretend I don't know anything about blind people and tell me how you do it. So I told him what I just told you. And he said, you need a computer. And I said, no, I don't. I don't want a computer. Well, you need a computer. And I said, I don't have any money for a computer. And he said, well, we'll open a case. That's what I do. And at the same time, I was asked to help organize a technology conference for blind Ohioans. At the same time, I got a call from the executive director of Clovernook Printing House for the Blind. And they knew me because I'd done some work for them and so forth. And he said, our board, you know, we transcribe all these magazines into Braille, but our board has the idea that it would be interesting to actually publish a magazine. And I thought of you because I know you're a writer. Would that be something you'd be interested in? Oh, yeah. What's it going to be about? Well, we don't know yet, but we wanted to first find out if you'd be interested in doing it. Oh, sure. So he calls me a week later. Well, we met again. What do you think about computers? Sure. That's a great idea. Yeah, no problem. I don't know anything about computers. I've never put my hands on a computer at this point.
So the accidental techie steps up to the microphone.
Exactly. So the computer that I chose was a tape-based VersaBraille. In December, we had the technology conference. It was a huge success in setting it up. Came to know all of these marvelous pioneers in our field. Fred Gassoni, Tim Cranmer, Harvey Lauer, Emerson Folk wasn't there, but I talked to him. Like, all of these remarkable, brilliant people who, absolutely, of course, were already steeped in technology. Mm-hmm. And so they came to the conference, and when I told them I'm launching a magazine and I'm scared to death, all of them, it was so amazing, Robert. These people went home and cleared out their filing cabinets and drawers and sent me boxes of papers they had written and little articles they had done for educational publications. There were a couple little newsletters around at that time. They just, tons of stuff. So I just read everything. And in a couple months' time, and I got my VersaBraille, and I got up to speed, and I launched the first issue of Tactic in March of 1985.
I remember it well. You know?
Do you really?
Absolutely. I loved Tactic magazine. You know, and one thing I loved about Tactic magazine was the design on the cover.
I know. Wasn't that fun?
That was such a such a neat design on the cover of that Braille magazine. And if you guys have never seen one, you should try to get a hold of a Tactic somewhere and just, if nothing else, look at the cover.
There were a couple of years when NLS put little tactile images on some of their magazines. I remember Playboy had a little bunny head with
Yes, I remember that.
And so when I started that, I said, I want it to feel good. I want something that's some kind of picture on the front. It was sort of vaguely supposed to represent a CRT screen.
Mm-hmm. Back then, life was so different than the way it is now. There was no internet. There was no downloadable way to quickly get information and news and publications and magazines and everything like we have now. And I looked so forward always to that Tactic magazine arriving in the mail. It was a different time back then.
Yeah. That is, I love hearing those kinds of things. And of course, I feel like I've known you forever, but you didn't write to me that early. I didn't know you went back to the beginning.
I first got involved in this technology probably 10 years before that with the Speech Plus calculator and the Opticon and like you later on the VersaBraille, things like that. So it's been almost, I've been involved in this stuff since I was 20 years old.
I had to be browbeaten to jump in, but man, I'll tell you, I had that VersaBraille for an hour and I was in love. I mean, that I could write a sentence and change it myself, and change a word or delete the whole sentence. I mean, it was magical. It was just something that, as blind people, we never could do before. You know, we couldn't. I mean, you could use whiteout on a typewriter, but
never anything like refreshable Braille before.
Yeah.
I had used computers, word processors a little bit prior to the VersaBraille, used them with speech. But there's nothing like being able to actually literally feel or see what you're doing in Braille to help you really understand what word processing is all about, when you can actually see how you can put the cursor on that word and delete it and it's gone, or how you can insert a word between those two words. It was a fabulous thing, really.
And to this day, I am an avid Braille. I say I'm Braille dependent because I have never worked in a speech only environment. In fact, I didn't use speech at all until I was forced to use Windows. Coming into Windows, initially, if you had Braille, you had to have speech with it. I think that was the deal. It seems to me that it was, I don't know, it was early 1990s, maybe 95, when I had speech for the first time. Until then, I was, exclusively Braille.
Certainly the speech window screen readers became more mature with speech more quickly than they did with Braille. And the drivers came along and they started supporting more and more Braille. But it is really unfortunate, that I think somehow, sounds like you didn't do this. I certainly did, though. Unfortunately, a lot of us for a while kind of thought, well, maybe Braille's not so important anymore because of all this speech technology. But today I realize that is absolutely wrong. And Braille is critically important. People have to be literate. They have to have a way of knowing how things are spelled and punctuated and laid out on the page. And I don't know of any way a blind person can do that nearly as well as doing it with Braille.
Absolutely. And I have never been without it. I've always had Braille displays with my computers, and I've always used Braille note takers. And when I bought one of those first Braille and Speaks, but you know how I used it? I used it constantly, but I connected it to a Braille embosser and spit my grade 3 notes out on Braille paper.
That's just how important having the Braille on the page was to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the Braille Bugging. Speak, you know, is one of the, it was a fabulous, fabulous device. And you know, I'll always be indebted to Dean Blasey and Tim Cranmer and Fred Gassani and those guys, some of those guys that you mentioned, for having developed that technology. But it is one of the places where, in a big way, for the first time, the idea of using a Braille keyboard with a speech synthesizer for the output became popular. And that's one of the things that I think was a bit unfortunate for Braille in some ways, although I get the practicality of it and I see why it happened and it actually did work. But you almost shouldn't have Braille writing without Braille reading, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, although it wasn't long. What was it? Well, maybe it seemed long at the time, but I know a lot of us bugged Gene Blasey, and he finally got the Braille light together, and I'm sure I bought one of the very first ones of those.
Yes.
And so at least, you know, there were enough of us who recognized that we needed. Did you ever see the Port-a-Braille?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So the idea, the concept was there all along, and then
yes.
It got lost in the Braille and Speak. But
It got lost, and you're right, it did come back. The unfortunate thing, though, is that an awful lot of people decided, well, I can only afford the one without the Braille display. And that was a reality of it and still is today. You know, we've got to find some way to make Braille more affordable to people who need it. Somehow we've got to find a way to do that.
And while we're talking about the Braille and Speak, let me go back now and tell you how I sent my 1990 ADA signing ceremony story back to the Cincinnati Enquirer.
Oh, it was
such a coup, because this is 1990, and you know how so often blind geeks are ahead of sighted geeks. And with the Braille and Speak, we definitely were.
We had the first laptops.
Absolutely. So I'm in a panic, and I you know, by now, you know, for quite some time by then, you know, I'd been using a modem and dial-up services and CompuServe and everything. But I knew that it must be possible to combine it with that Braille and Speak and somehow, anyway. So I just started calling, and I'm ashamed to say that I don't remember who now anymore. But remember, I'm the accidental techie. I'm the one who can learn how to use things and take something, you know, and learn it inside and out to write about it in English so ordinary mortals can understand it. But I'm not the one who figures these things out. So I just started calling all my smart techie friends who were tactic readers and contributors and saying, help me, how do I do this? And I don't remember who or how, but got it put together to take a modem with me that was about the size of the Braille and Speak.
Yep.
And connect to the phone line in the hotel room. And it was one of the few stories ever that I wrote completely on the Braille and Speak. And I'm nervous because I'm not a speech user, you know, to get it. But and sent it to that pesky editor over the phone, over the modem. And I was so happy that when I got home and saw my story, he hadn't tampered with it. It was okay.
So he got it fine, and it was all there, and it was in the paper.
Yeah, yeah.
Fabulous, fabulous. And that's a great marriage of several technologies there for that time. You were lucky enough to have a modem, and it was lucky that it was able to connect through the hotel phone lines, and you were able to actually get the Braille Speak to transmit the story. A lot of things had to go right for you.
It was a miracle, and but it took a lot of sweat too.
Sure, no doubt about that.
it was so thrilling to see it work. I think that we all, you know, when you talk about CompuServe, I mean, I think I was doing, and probably you were too, Robert, doing all that dial-up stuff and, shopping online and everything long before a lot of sighted people even had email.
Absolutely. Yeah, I was on CompuServe, and I was on a service called Genie, which I really liked, and I used my Braille and Speak and Braille lights to get online that way as well. But I also used some software by Larry Skutkan called ProTerm on the Apple computer, which was a terminal program, and it worked great. And we get on bulletin board systems and CompuServe, and wow, that was way before the internet.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you sort of got into the technology. Your friend at the fundraiser kind of pushed you and said, hey, you know, you need to get going on this computer. You got the VersaBraille, you got going. And then, of course, I guess when Tactic came along and you really were focusing on a technology magazine and you had to read all those articles and everything, you really had to jump into it with both feet and learn a whole lot in a hurry, it sounds like.
I did. I'm first and foremost a writer, and writers are insatiably curious. You know, I have friends who sometimes will say jokingly, if we're meeting someone new, look out, you know, she'll interview you before you know it, you know, and something you say might wind up in print. But I'm insatiably curious, and I doubt that it's going to stop since it's been here all my life. And
I sure hope not.
So learning about, even though in a vacuum, when people mentioned technology to me previously, I was, oh, no, I don't care. In fact, I had a voc rehab counselor who 10 years before had begged me to let him send me for Opticon training. And I said, no, I don't want to do that. What do I want to do that for? What? I can read Braille 400 words a minute. What do I want to go read some stupid print that if you work hard, you can read 40 words a minute? That's ridiculous. Well, of course, now I know I was ridiculous, and I really regret that. But thinking about technology in that, you know, global sort of way, I wasn't interested. But once I got into it and got my hands on stuff at that conference that we organized, and then started reading all the stuff these guys sent me, and the first issue of Tactic was out, and I'm talking to all these, I was in love. And
isn't, you know, that really what drives it, though? I mean, that's what always drives it for you, is that passion. It finally meant something to you. You saw the value in it. You saw how exciting it was and what you could do with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Until people can really understand why it would be worth it to them to do that work, we don't have nearly enough people getting enough out of their technology, I don't believe.
I do a little bit of training these days. I pick and choose. I don't learn anything unless I have to, so I can't teach the whole smorgasbord of technology. But I love teaching people to use the basics of JAWS and Window Eyes to get them up and running. I especially love teaching people to use Braille note takers. But I think the key is always finding what that single most interesting spark is going to be for each individual. And that's tricky.
Yeah.
You know, for me, it was just words, that I can write my words and see them myself. I don't need anybody to read them back to me, and I can change them. You know, for me, that was it. But it's something different for everyone. For some people, it's, I can use a computer to balance my checkbook,
which
is something I've never done.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, me either. But you know, the thing is, when you're writing in Braille on a Perkins Brailler, and you can't really change things, you can't really rearrange sentences or edit on the page, you have to keep so much in your head that your concepts, your ideas, and when you can actually word process them on a Braille device, I would assume that you can free yourself up a bit to be maybe even more creative.
Somewhat, but sort of a curious thing about my writing, and I think this might go back to the days when I couldn't rewrite or change because of using a Perkins Braille or a typewriter.
Right.
I tend, you know, by now I've published probably thousands of articles. And for example, this morning when I wrote my newspaper column, I pretty much wrote it from start to finish and changed a few words.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way I work. And I'm working on a really big project now. And I'll mention what it is in case any of your listeners have any anecdotes they want to share with me. I'm writing Dr. Abraham Nemeth's biography.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and it's such a big project because he's such a remarkable human being. And I keep telling myself, you don't have to write the chapter perfect the first time. Just write, and go back and fix. And it's a kind of a new concept for me, and I'm trying to make myself approach it that way because I think I'll get hung up less because I keep getting stuck, you know.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. When I did my PhD dissertation, you know, I would pretty much write a whole chapter, and with very little revision, that would be the final draft of the chapter. I had it all in my head, and that's just how we had to work back then.
I think that's it. I think that as blind people, we just had to do so much work in the head before it went on the paper.
I don't want to keep you terribly long here, even though this is absolutely delightful to talk about this stuff, but I do have a couple questions I wanted to follow up on. One is, how long did Tactic Magazine run, from when to when?
15 years, from the beginning of 1985 to the end of 1999.
So it had a long run. And
it did.
It covered a lot of technology.
Basically, you know, AFB came to me. It was really very flattering. The American Foundation for the Blind did some sort of, I don't know, market research or whatever, and they wanted to launch a technology magazine. And basically what they learned was Tactic had the market. I mean, we're a small market and not to compete. And so they subsumed a Tactic and brought me on board to help launch Access World, which, you know, in its early days looked a lot like Tactic when it was still hard copy.
Yes, it did.
I love the fact that, you know, I've continued to be a part of all of this and that technology has continued to be such a big part of what I do. And I know you feel the same way. You go to exhibits at a show and it's like being a kid in a candy store, you know? It's like, ooh, let's see all the new toys. It's so much fun.
Yes, absolutely. You continue to write articles for Access World. I frequently see articles by you in there.
Oh, yeah. I'm called Senior Features Editor.
Okay.
So that's a nice title, right? And, yeah, I don't think there's been an issue of Access World without at least one article by me, sometimes two. But, yeah, I've written continuously at least one or two articles for every issue. You know, on our forecast calendar, I have a long list of articles scheduled as we speak.
And has it changed things much for you that Access World has gone to an electronic publication?
You know, I'm no longer editing, and so the responsibility is far less. And at first, I was saddened by that, but now I'm grateful. In that, I wouldn't want to be responsible for the whole publication. On the other hand, because everything is electronic now, I love that. I love that when I write for anybody, I could just email my story. I mean, there were years and years when I would take the bus and hand deliver my stories sometimes, you know, in order to get them there on time.
Oh, I can imagine.
I confess that I don't know anywhere near as much about formatting as I did in the days of, you know, WordPerfect 5.1. I mean, then I could format a document, you know, with as much style as any sighted writer, but there's no way I could today because I haven't kept up with it, you know, in Word 2010 now. I haven't kept up with all those things, and I don't need to Because I know I'm emailing it and someone else will do it.
So you know? Today, do you write your stories in plain text or do you write them in – how do you write them today?
I write them all in Microsoft Word.
Okay.
Depending on the publication, like with Access World, you know, I insert some HTML coding to make it easier for the web people.
Uh-huh.
And every publication is different. Like when I submit things to the Columbus Dispatch, what I do for them is I write it in Microsoft Word, and then I cut and paste it into the body of an email message. That's how they want it.
So they just really want the text.
They want the text, yeah. So I will sometimes, you know, if I'm on vacation or I'm at a conference and I have a column due, I've written many columns on a Braille note or a Braille sense or a Braille light. And
I was just going to ask you that.
So them, yeah.
You could do it that way if you wanted to.
I could. And it's funny, you know, we form habits and we don't always know why, and we kind of go down certain paths. And in talking with Deborah Kent Stein, who's also a writer and blind and a good friend of mine, I realized recently she writes everything on a Braille note taker.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of kicking myself because I'm realizing that's so much easier. Why don't I do that anymore? I stopped, and I don't know why. I haven't been for about 10 years, but all through the 90s, I did a lot of magazine work, feature writing for a lot of regional and national magazines, and you were still submitting the manuscripts through the mail. So they had to look good.
Yeah, of course.
But now, you know, if you look through submission guidelines, most mainstream publications will now take, and I would say the majority prefer, email submissions.
I happen to know, Deborah, that you have started using some of the Apple technology that use the iPhone. What do you think about this new generation of technology, especially the Apple products? This podcast has a bit of an Apple bias, so I'm curious what you think about it.
Well, you know, Robert, if there's any theme about my relationship with technology, it is that each time there's something new, Deborah comes kicking and screaming into the noon. So,
I love it.
So I was late coming to Windows. I was going to cling to DOS for life until a computer finally died. And, you know, and then each phase of Windows, you know, I didn't want to go to the next generation. So in 2009, I remember sitting at a convention in a bar with two friends, one new friend, one old friend, who both had iPhones. And I thought, they're crazy. What is wrong with these people? My one friend showed it to me, and I'm thinking, this is only for really insane, geeky, blind people, because there are no buttons, and I don't understand what he's doing with that touchscreen, but I just think he's out of his mind, and
yep,
there's no way. So then more and more people were getting them, and so then I had this crutch. I said, I'm not getting an iPhone until Verizon gets iPhones, because I'm never leaving my provider. I'm never leaving Verizon. And I did have a really nice little phone with a nice keyboard that I'd begun texting, and, you know, so life was okay. I refused to use a third-party program, so I wasn't using Tox or Mobile Squeak. So then Verizon foiled me, because February 3rd of 2011.
Yeah.
And so guess who was online that night at midnight ordering an iPhone, because the pressure was on. All these people were saying, you know, you said you'd do it. And so now, that said, the first month, the learning curve was steep, and I did get Anna and Dean's book from National Braille Press, and
great
was
book.
So grateful for it. It
excellent
was
book. Yep.
So helpful. But after about a month, like everything before it, I was in love. I love my iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
I love my – oh, and thank you to you, because when we – got together a few weeks ago and you paired it with my Refresh-A-Braille, it's been like a whole new experience for me. I'm like in love all over again with my iPhone.
Now you have an iPhone with a Braille display.
I do. So, you know, it's the best of all worlds.
I am so glad that that's working for you. That's fabulous.
Yeah, I do love it. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not doing email with it yet. My email comes in on it and I read it, but I haven't tried replying to emails. Yeah. I just read them or delete them or whatever. But I'm almost there.
Well, you know, Deborah, it has been such a pleasure to talk with you and have you on this podcast. My wife Vicki and I are so happy that we got to spend some time with you and in Dallas. And
it was so much fun.
You've just been someone that I have known of and known somewhat over the years and always admired and respected for what you've done and always enjoyed your writing. And I really do thank you for spending some time on the Tech Doctor podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's been a blast. We could just fill a book reminiscing about old technology.
We really could. And we just might have to do a part two sometime this year. And because there's so much more, especially when your new book comes out.
Oh, yeah. And could I give my email or something? So if people have Abe Nemeth stories they want to share, they can contact me?
Please do.
Okay. If you have something significant, like a memory of Dr. Nemeth, of spending time with him, or a strong story of what the Nemeth Code has meant to you, I would love to hear from anyone. And my email address is dkkendrick, dkkendrick, at earthlink.net.
Excellent.
Or you can ask the tech doctor if you lose it.
Yes, because you can always get in touch with me at techdoctor123@gmail.com. Please let us hear from you. Thanks again, Deborah. So long, everybody. Until next time.